Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue. Today we talk about the optimal management of neuroendocrine tumors. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Pam Kuntz from the Yale School of Medicine, Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut, and Dr. Simran Singh from the University of Toronto and the Odette Cancer Center, Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We also are going to show you a survey where we included four other investigators in that of their usual treatment practices. As we always do in our webinars, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. In the chat room, you'll find a one-minute pre-meeting and also after the meeting, a post-meeting survey. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this experience here today. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs, and we actually did a program with Dr. Kuntz from our Oncology Today podcast series, so check that out. We're about to head out to Houston and the SOHO meetings. We're going to be doing two CME programs that will also be live webcast September 4th on CAR T therapy and non-Hodgkin lymphoma and CLL. And the same day, the 4th, at 7:30, we'll be doing another program on the management of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We'll be heading out to San Diego then for the World Lung Meetings, where we'll be doing a couple of CME programs. Again, we'll be broadcasting nationally on September 11th, a program looking at targeted therapy beyond EGFR. We have another program on non-targeted therapy, particularly immunotherapy. And we maybe add another one on EGFR we're working on right now. Then on September 17th, we're going to start our a series on Meet the Professor of CLL. We'll have a bunch of cases presented by community-based oncologists. Just a note for those of you who are heading out to ASH this year, we're doing six programs there on their big CME day. But I'm really excited here to talk about neuroendocrine tumors. We don't get the opportunity to do that too often. And there's so much to talk about here today. We're really excited. As in all of our meetings, we will be talking about the use of non-approved agents and regimens. So check out package inserts for more information. As we do with a lot of our webinars, I met with each of the faculty individually over the last couple of weeks to record a presentation. And this really is a three-part program, each of their presentations. And then this webinar today, where we're really going to try to go beyond all the content that's discussed, the cases in these really great presentations. Incidentally, the presentations are in the chat room. If you want to watch them after this, you can check it out. And then we're going to mail out all three programs where a lot of people end up using the content. We picked out some of the slides from these two talks. But really, what I really did was I compiled a list of questions that after kind of going through these talks, talked to a couple of our oncology, general medical oncology consultants about it. And we came up with a list of questions we want to throw out at you. We only have 38 of them that we're going to try to get through. I don't think we're going to actually get through all of them. We actually started out with 50, but we narrowed it down to 38. And here, the way we're going to break it out, first, we're just going to chat about NET in general. And then we'll get into the two major advances we want to focus on today. The first, the use of peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, ludotatate specifically in the first-line setting, the use of TKIs, but in particularly new data on cabozantinib. And then we'll talk about some other advances, including the use of belzutifan. But first, let's just talk a little bit about an overview of the field. And Pam, this is a program we did. Just to get, you know, we mentioned the fact that our primary target audience is general medical oncologists. And I thought a good example of what medical oncology is like is a program we recorded last Friday on biliary tract cancers, where we only spent 3 hours talking about biliary tract cancers. And actually, we didn't even get through the entire agenda. So, you know, it's kind of like, and I think about NET trying to even get through this with these three programs. Any reflections back on, specifically in terms of NET, Pam, you've been involved with this for a while. To me, it just seems like it's really exploded over the last decade.
No, it really has. I would say, you know, since 2011 is when we started seeing results from large randomized phase 3 trials. And it was really early 2000s, it was finally recognized by funders and by investigators that this was in fact a field and an area that was worthy of investment. And so it's been really exciting to see the field evolve and be part of that, along with Dr. Singh and others. So it's, I think, hopeful. It's something that I really try to impart to my patients, that this is a really hopeful time. We have so many more diagnostic tools and therapeutic tools.
So I'm just kind of curious in terms of any maybe say myths or misperceptions, Simran, that you see in the community, a couple that, I think a lot of people think about this as being a very uncommon disease in a community-based setting. But yet when I've been asking people, they have people in their practice with it. And another thing that people I think have this vision of is that it's, you know, usually not a very aggressive disease, compatible with long-term survival, even the metastatic disease. And yet in your talk, you go into the fact that that maybe is not exactly the case. Any thoughts?
No, those are two really important points. I think when it comes down to it, neuroendocrine is unfortunately more common than we originally had ever thought. The incidence has been rising, and that's been shown through two nice papers by Dr. Yao and Dr. Dasari through the SEER database. And this is globally. We see that we've done the same studies in Canada. It's been done in Europe, in Australia, in Asia, and we see the same rising trend in incidence. Whether it's because there's just more cases coming through or we're just better at diagnosing and classifying, it almost to me doesn't matter. What matters is that we have a lot of patients who have this disease. In terms of prevalence, it's actually the second most common prevalent GI cancer after colon cancer right now. So there's a lot of patients out there that are living with neuroendocrine cancer every day. So it's important that we have the resources and the attention that we can to improve their well-being. And as you alluded to, Neil, one of the misconceptions, and I think it's changing, and I'm glad to see it's changing, was that, these are very indolent cancers. And this term carcinoid, which we try to avoid using now, was this cancer-like, a very slow-growing tumor. But that's not always the case. Patients who have metastatic disease, unfortunately, their outcomes are much different than colorectal cancer. And so, as we move forward with all these trials that Pam has been talking about, we're getting better outcomes and we're being able to treat our patients better than we were, even just as much as a decade ago.
So, Pam, I want you to keep in mind a case that just popped into the chat room from Asan. Maybe we can refer back to this as we start to get further into this. 36-year-old man, abdominal pain for a few days, extensive liver mets, biopsy, NET, multiple abdominal nodes, Q67, 90%, grade 3, PET dotatate positive as also. Any initial thoughts based, one of the things to me, I think that with all the new things that are coming out, I'm thinking about biliary too. There's just so many new things in terms of the classification and how you actually, when you see a patient who comes in like that, how do you fit them in to the classification? Can you talk more broadly? Again, we have docs out there, they're seeing CLL, myeloma, bladder cancer. We try to, get to the key, like, what do you look at when you first see a patient like this presenting with metastatic disease?
I think having a great pathologist is really important. And I rely on having some minimum data elements in my pathology report. So I want to have that WHO grade. I want to have differentiation, so well differentiated or poorly differentiated. I like to have the Ki-67. And if possible, this would be more by imaging, I'd like to know what the primary site is. So for this case, with a Ki-67 over 90%, that makes me worried. Typically, that's going to be poorly differentiated in neuroendocrine carcinoma. And that usually means we need to be thinking about chemotherapy like platinum etoposide. So this is really more like we borrow from the small cell lung cancer literature some, where this is an evolving field in the neuroendocrine carcinoma space. But this is a patient for whom I'm worried will have a more aggressive course.
So we'll keep that in mind, particularly as we get into new approaches. But let's talk about some of the questions that at least came up in my mind when we recorded your presentations that I think are common questions. And this is one we actually asked in the survey that I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you the results of the survey of you and your other colleagues we asked. But one, I guess, kind of interesting, Simran, is should patients with NET be in some way hooked up to a center of excellence, tertiary center? It could be virtually, but should they have input from people? You mentioned that NET's getting to be pretty common in the community. Do all patients ideally need to have some kind of input from a tertiary center?
Look, I don't think it's absolutely mandatory, but I think it's helpful. And I think it's helpful for the providers, and I think it's helpful for the patients. And one of the few advantages of COVID has been the growth that we have in virtual medicine and telemedicine. And so that ability now has been has allowed us to develop partnerships with our community oncologists in many different regions throughout North America where we can work together to, you know, improve our care of our patients. So, you know, is it helpful, I think, for neuroendocrine patients to have involvement, even to consider if there's clinical trials available, are there new therapies available that they may avail themselves of? I think yes. Does care only have to happen at these large neuroendocrine centers? No, I think partnership works well. And sometimes, you know, working together at forks in the road where decision making can be made together is important. And that takes into account, you know, the patient's need to travel, the patient's ability to travel, and also their preferences and what's available to them.
So we heard about this patient with the Ki-67 and 90%, but let's flip back to the other end, Pam. And I guess one question is, you know, these questions have been out there for a while, but I just want to sort of kind of update in terms of what kind of patients would you observe even with metastatic disease?
That's a great question. And I think that that's an important point that for some patients, typically these are patients with low volume disease who are asymptomatic and may have been incidentally diagnosed. Those are patients that I might consider observing. Now, I want to acknowledge, and I have this conversation with my patients, this is really a perfect time for shared decision making. I think that patients who are newly diagnosed with metastatic disease may understandably feel very uncomfortable with the idea of observation. So it's really thinking about observation and somatostatin analogs is often the conversation that I'm having with them. Patients who are symptomatic or have bulkier disease, these are not patients that I would observe.
So let's talk a little bit about somatostatin analogs. First of all, Simran, how do you select an SSA and how do you discuss it with the patient? Do you, if you have access, would you offer both options?
Yeah, I mean, there's two agents currently available, and then there's generics coming on the market or have come on the market depending on where you are. To me, it's a class effect. I actually don't see too much difference between both of them. So I think things like, you know, one is an IM injection. The other is what they call a deep sub-Q, but it's still a fairly large needle. There are trials coming forward looking at new agents that are high potency SSAs and are subcutaneous injections, which I'm very excited about. So to me, there's not much difference between both of them in terms of their efficacy. Perhaps the deep sub-Q is a little bit more palpable for the patients, but they're still, you know, in, you know, fairly large injections that need to be taken at similar intervals of every 28 days.
So a couple other practical questions, Pam. In patients who have a clear-cut disease progression on an SSA, in what situations, if any, will you continue the SSA or maybe intensify the dose? Another question that we got from docs is, how often do you see transformation from low-grade to high-grade?
Yep, all good questions. So focusing on the SSA-related questions first. So if a patient has progression on an SSA, I will continue the SSA if they have a functional NET. So functional meaning they have measurable hormone in the urine or the blood and have symptoms from that hormone. So the classic example of that is carcinoid syndrome. That's the one exception. We still use the word carcinoid. So I will continue SSAs. Really, those patients often need lifelong control with an SSA. The debate about sort of using above standard doses for tumor control is a bit controversial. We have single arm data from the Clarinet Forte study looking at this, but again, it's single arm. So I tend to not use above standard dose kind of doubling dose, for example, at time of progression to achieve tumor control, I usually switch classes entirely. Be eager to hear if Dr. Singh, what his thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I might have a slightly different approach. I agree that it's not certainly a home run in any situation. The Clarinet Fort did show some benefit in patients with low Ki-67. I think it was about 25% still had disease control at 12 months. And then we have the control arms of NETTER-1 and NETTER-2, both with high dose SSA showing around 8 to 9 months PFS. So I do use it occasionally, mostly in patients who have had very slow progression, low-grade disease. They don't want to go on to the next therapy, which may involve new toxicities and new therapy. So often it's people who may have a borderline performance status, recognizing that it might just buy some time to bridge to another therapy. The other time I would agree with Pam to continue SSAs would be functional disease. And sometimes when we have patients who have, you know, functional disease that were difficult to control and we're trying to bridge to another therapy, we have telotrostat, which we can use, if you have access to it. Or, you know, sometimes even events like liver embolization, I may use it as a bridge to the point of getting embolization of the liver and then try to bring it back down. So those can sometimes be times. The continuing SSA argument is an interesting one. I agree with Pam. I only continue in the functional neuroendocrine tumors, but there are some people that would say this may sort of defy our normal oncological thinking of stopping a treatment at progression. And there's a couple of interesting trials going forward in that area. One is a smaller trial looking at SSAs, if we need to continue them post-PRT. And that's being done by the ComNets group between Canada, Australia, and New Zealand called StopNet. There is another larger trial that being done by the Scandinavian countries called SAUNA that is looking at SSAs post-progression, both in PRT, but also for other medical therapies, if we should be continuing or not. Because that's always been an issue of debate as well, whether SSA should continue beyond progression.
So, Pam, a lot of questions about imaging in NETs. Can you kind of provide an overview of how you view that in various situations?
Sure. So I would say that the primary method of imaging for patients with NETs is with cross-sectional imaging with either a multiphasic CT scan or an MRI. Certainly at time of diagnosis, I also get somatostatin receptor-based imaging. Where I practice, that's typically gallium-68 dotapet, copper-64 dotapet's also approved. We've really moved away from using octreoscan scan, although if that's your only available diagnostic tool, that's acceptable, but I would say that the PET-based somatostatin receptor imaging is far superior in terms of resolution. Monitoring patients over time is typically done with the cross-sectional imaging. I would say how to use somatostatin receptor-based imaging for patients with metastatic disease over time is a bit variable. There's actually a great article on appropriate use criteria for somatostatin receptor-based imaging that I often reference. My personal practice is I usually get gallium-68 dotapet every 1 to 2 years for patients with metastatic disease. I think it does a really good job of showing extent of disease, and I think that it often captures bone metastatic disease better than our cross-sectional imaging.
So, Simran, questions about genetic testing in these patients. Do you get it in all patients? Is there a particular family or medical history that prompts you to do it? Any specific mutations you're looking for? And also, it seems like RB and TP53 is something of particular interest in NETs. What platforms do you use, and where does liquid biopsy fit in? All in 30 seconds, Simran. Just kidding.
Yeah. Got it. Genetics in 30 seconds. So I think we haven't really, at least I haven't, I think most of my colleagues wouldn't routinely offer genetic testing for all patients. Although I think as we start to develop new therapies, like belzutifan for VHL, the need to test starts to increase somewhat. So that is changing our practices. Personally, for patients who are under 40, I refer them for genetic testing. And for patients, especially if they have a pancreatic neuroendocrine primary looking for MEN1 syndrome, and if they have a family history of any of those that would raise a suspicion for especially MEN1, et cetera, was where I'd refer to. not looking for any specific somatic mutations. Sometimes we do that when we're potentially thinking about whether there's any salvage therapy that we have possible. Sometimes with immuno-oncology, we know that the data is still somewhat to be determined in terms of when we can use checkpoint inhibitors in NET. So sometimes we may look for MSI or tumor mutational burden to maybe help us push us in one direction about using checkpoint inhibitors. So that's sort of where we're at. I think liquid biopsy is an interesting area, especially with the diagnostic problems we do have. There are some entities that are looking at liquid biopsy, and we're seeing more and more. So I wouldn't be surprised in the years to come if we have developed an appropriate liquid biopsy for NETs. There's a number of groups that are looking at this to try to understand if we can look at a specific gene profile that would potentially help us diagnose these patients earlier. And I think that would go a long way to improving outcomes as well.
So Simran, just a quick follow-up to your thought about checkpoint inhibitors from Gian in the chat room. There's strategy used in so many cancers nowadays. Any data on use of checkpoint inhibitors combined with chemo for high-grade metastatic NET, high Ki-67, you know, strategies used lung cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And also, what do you see in terms of PD-1 and TMB in NETs, Simran?
Yeah, so the data, you know, there's a lot of trials or, you know, smaller trials, albeit that are moving forward in checkpoint inhibitors and radioligand therapy, checkpoint inhibitors and chemotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors and TKIs. I think the goal is we're trying to look at how we can improve outcome. There is some data to say that maybe chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors like temozolomide causing the DNA damage will help with the checkpoint inhibitors. And so I think there's a couple of groups that are trying to look forward in that. I think what the common theme is we're trying to open the door, because the reality is the TMB is really low in neuroendocrine tumors generally. And I think where we all expected to see better results was in the poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas. And even there, the results haven't been, at least in my viewpoint, outstanding for checkpoint inhibitors, which was a bit surprising. So I think right now we don't have a consensus on where and how to use checkpoint inhibitors, but hopefully we'll open that door at least somewhat for our patients. I don't know, Pam, if you think any differently.
Yeah, I'll just add one thing, that there is a NCTN trial for poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, really modeled after some of the original lung studies. It's platinum etoposide plus or minus atezo plus or minus atezo maintenance. So it's a three-arm study. So that will also be critically important to see if we truly can extrapolate from the small cell lung cancer literature.
So maybe, Simran, you can respond to a case from Julie, who says, I have a patient with well-differentiated pancreatic NET with extensive biopsy-proven liver mets, Ki-67, 50%, PET dotatate positive in the pancreatic mass, but liver mets negative. Had progressive disease on CAPE-10, more recently on CDDP, VP-16, and atezo. Any role for PRRT?
Yeah, so I mean, the NETTER 2 trial, which was recently released, would show that patients who have well-differentiated grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor seem to do well on radioligand therapy or lutetium dotatate in that study in particular. The concern I have would be the fact that the liver metastases are not SSTR positive. So the key point we need to remember for PRRT is there has to be a place for it to land and connect to. So the target has to be there. And so I would be somewhat hesitant, if that is the case, to use PRRT of any sort with someone who doesn't have good SSTR receptor expression, because that really does indicate that we're not going to be able to lock the target into the tumor.
You guys actually have one of the earliest targeted therapies in oncology, I guess, when you think about it. You get in there early. I want to, there are a couple slides that you showed, Pam. I think it really will introduce where we're heading for the rest of the program here. Really trying to focus on a couple of major developments we've already alluded to here. Can you talk a little bit about this slide in your talk?
Sure. This is my version of adapting the NCCN guidelines. So credit originally to the NCCN guidelines. But I think this sort of simplifies it. So this is thinking about therapies beyond somatostatin analogs for patients with small bowel NETs and patients with pancreatic NETs and kind of where we are sort of at present. In blue are FDA approved therapies, and in red represent two therapies for which we've had large randomized phase 3 trials this year report out. They're not yet FDA approved. We are hoping they will be, but they're currently being evaluated. So I think the nice thing is, and when I talk to patients, I talk about all of the available tools in the toolbox for patients with metastatic disease, the likelihood that they will get all of those tools. It's our job as physicians and in partnership with our patients to really talk through and tailor. Yeah, this is the next slide of really tailoring that treatment. And I think Simran has addressed this earlier, but it's thinking about like, what are our goals of treatment for the patient? What are the characteristics of the patient themselves? Many of our agents that are approved for NETs yield stability. There are going to be some patients who are really in need of objective tumor shrinkage. We don't have that many available therapies that do that. I would highlight that as another unmet need. But our available therapies that do yield objective shrinkage tend to be chemotherapy and lutetium dotatate. So it's really thinking about what are your goals? What does the patient look like in front of you? Are there any comorbidities that may exclude a certain therapy? But I'll happy to have Simran comment on that too.
No, very well said. I think stability is the goal many times for some patients, and that's okay, right? That is completely fine. We're having our patients, you know, I talk to many of my low-grade patients with this, and we say, people live with diabetes, people live with chronic kidney disease, people live with arthritis. We're going to try to make it, as Pam quite nicely said, that you're going to live with this disease and have you have as much of a normal life as possible with this disease. And then there's some patients who have more aggressive disease where we need to, you know, shrink the tumor down and we need to kill cancer cells. And, you know, luckily we're starting to see more treatment coming forward in that way.
I'll tell you, I'm seeing a lot of cases and questions in the chat room. We're never going to, I mean, this is really evidence of what you're saying. It's a lot more common than I think people think it is, but let's get to some of the data first, and particularly as it relates to NETTER-2. What a fascinating trial that Simran ran. But maybe you can talk first a little bit, Pam, about NETTER-1 that preceded it.
Sure. NETTER-1 set us up for the FDA approval of ludotatate. So this was a randomized phase 3 study that looked at patients with metastatic small intestine neuroendocrine tumors, or midgut, randomized 1-to-1 to receive 4 doses of lutetium dotatate. That's the kind of the standard treatment versus high-dose octreotide. So as we can see in this slide, the lutetium dotatate prolonged progression-free survival compared to the high-dose octreotide. At the time it was presented, the ludotatate median PFS was not reached. We now know in follow-up that it's at about 2.5 years. The hazard ratio was pretty remarkable at 0.21, so 79% reduction in the hazard of progression. And then a key takeaway, thanks for picking up on where I'm headed, is the response rate. So the response rate was about 18% in the ludotatate group compared to 3% in the control group. So 1 in 5 patients had a significant amount of tumor shrinkage. A reminder, this is the small bowel patient population. Those patients tend to be kind of less resistant, less shrinkage in that patient population than compared to pancreatic NET. This was a really well-tolerated treatment. The most common side effects were cytopenias, nausea, vomiting, and fatigue. One thing I want to highlight, because there's a lot of talk about this both within patient communities and kind of perception among treating oncologists, is around myelodysplastic syndrome. So the reported rates are about 2-3%. So it happens. Tell patients it is a serious but rare side effect. And I think that the benefits of this treatment far outweigh that risk.
So in a second, I'll ask Simran to talk a little bit about the NETTER-2. But Simran, I got to tell you, in the chat room, Dawn says one of her patients says stable is the new remission.
I like that. I steal that. Thank you.
You might have to steal it from her. Okay, so yes. Let's talk about this first-line study, NETTER-2. Can you talk about that, Simran?
Sure. So, you know, in recent years, as we've come to really understand neuroendocrine tumors better, this new entity has been described, you know, the well-differentiated grade 3. Before, all grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors were automatically treated as poorly differentiated carcinomas. And we found that there was an in-between. They weren't exactly like the low-grade neuroendocrine tumors that benefited from somatostatin analogs or at least standard dose. And then they weren't exactly patients that benefited from platinum-based chemotherapy. So the NETTER-2 trial was to look at these slightly more aggressive neuroendocrine tumors, the higher grade 2s, the Ki-67 10% and above, and then the well-differentiated grade 3s. It followed on the NETTER-1 study, again, using 4 cycles of lutetium dotatate. And then patients were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to receive 4 cycles of lutetium dotatate versus 60 milligrams of octreotide LAR, so a higher dose of somatostatin analogs as per the NETTER-1 trial. Pam had mentioned that the NETTER-1 trial included patients with small bowel neuroendocrine tumors who had progressed on somatostatin analog. The patient group for this was slightly different. This was a first-line therapy. These are people who had not received prior therapy, so this is a first-line therapy of patients who had, as I mentioned, a higher grade 2 or grade 3 of any GI origin at all. Key points, however, was that they had to have really good SSTR expression. So we want to make sure that the target is there. And again, the primary outcomes was progression-free survival, as is the case and should be the case for most neuroendocrine trials when we look at feasibility. So the endpoints, we had a chance to release them just this year from our primary analysis. It was 22.8 months versus slightly over 8 months, the hazard ratio of 0.276. So a 72% reduction in the risk of disease progression or death with first-line lutetium dotatate. So really good results that we were excited to see, showing that these patients who have slightly more aggressive neuroendocrine tumors could benefit from first-line radioligand therapy. And when we looked at all the subgroups, and one of the nice things of it being an international trial is we had heterogeneity in our patient population, including Asian patients, et cetera, gender. But when we also looked at the subgroups, such as the pancreas versus non-pancreas and grade 2 versus grade 3, there was all a hazard ratio that favored lutetium dotatate in this situation. One of the areas that that we were pleasantly happy to see was the high response rates. As Pam mentioned, the response rate for lutetium dotatate was 18% in the NETTER-1 trial, albeit in a small bowel, lower grade population. But in this population, we saw a response rate of 43%, including about a 5% CR rate. These are high response rates. You know, Pam's did an excellent study in chemotherapy on the E2211, showed similar type of response rates. So, you know, we're able to see that we're slowly developing that armamentarium of agents that we can use when we really need to shrink disease down. And you know, there's been some thought about whether this control arm should have been high dose SSAs or, you know, when we designed it, Pam's 2211 trial wasn't available at that time. It wasn't finished. But now that we know that there is some role for chemotherapy, but the response rate to me at least gives some face validity to it, that regardless of the control arm, the high response rate does show that there is activity to this agent in first line. Toleration, I mean, 88% of patients completed all four cycles, so it was well tolerated. Common side effects were as expected. There was some nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain. Interestingly, much of that was actually seen more in the high-dose SSA arm. But then we saw the cytopenias. There was some, you know, liver inflammation. There was a few cases of small intestine obstruction, which can happen when you're using RLT with mesenteric, you know, high-dose mesenteric disease, something to be cautionary of. But, you know, the key thing we're all looking for is the MDS rate. You know, the question is by moving RLT to first line, and this is the first trial that's using RLT in any cancer first line at all. And I think this is something we're going to see a lot more of. You know, we've now seen, of course, in prostate cancer, but we're also seeing in breast, HCC, trials are going to move forward. This is going to be a very, you know, I like to think of it as like, it's going to be the next IO in terms of how we treat cancer. But the key point is going to be monitoring the MDS rate. At the time of report, there was only one case of MDS in this cohort, but this is still early data. And I think we need to follow through with it to truly understand what that rate is. But so far, no red flags.
So, Pim, can you comment a little bit more about what your experience is and what we know from the literature in terms of tolerability of this therapy and also the precautions that are taken? I think we're familiar with what's done with lutetium and prostate cancer in terms of safety precautions. Is it very similar, I guess, in this situation? And how do patients tolerate therapy?
Yeah, happy to address those things. So actually, a perfect example is that most patients come back to me, especially after that first or second cycle, and say, "Doc, that was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be." So it's a really very well-tolerated treatment. Acute side effects are really minimal. Some patients may have mild nausea, mostly associated with amino acid infusion. We pre-medicate with antiemetics. It's gotten lots better since the like first generations of the amino acid solutions we were using. Patients may have some mild fatigue. The other side effects like cytopenias and more significant fatigue are usually cumulative and don't usually happen until the third or fourth cycle, if at all. So very well tolerated. In terms of the radiation safety, most institutions partner with their radiation safety teams to develop a protocol. They're probably pretty standard across most of our institutions. Typically, that means about 3 days where we recommend that patients stay at home, don't spend a lot of time with and in close proximity with others. They don't sleep with a partner. If they can use a private bathroom, we recommend that, that there are ways to work around that. So it's really patients secrete radiation in their urine for those 3 days. So it's taking extra precautions around exposing others to that. But really the takeaway is that it is a very safe therapy. There's more of a perceived risk to the public than an actual risk. That radiation particle travels millimeters. And so this is an extra conservative way of making radiation safety recommendations to patients.
So, Simran, I'm going to ask you a simple question that I don't think has a simple answer, but I've got to. You know, we were talking about the complexities of how you all view these diseases or this disease. And I'm curious right now, you know, obviously we don't have access to this yet in the first line, but theoretically, based on the data that we have right now, what are the situations where you think you would like to use ludotatate first line, Simran?
Yeah, I think in patients who have well-differentiated grade 3, you know, so higher Ki-67 gastrointestinal neuroendocrine tumors. And the key point here is that they have good high expression of SSTR receptors. I think they would be a really good option for those patients. And then I think in the higher grade 2s as well, we know, you know, we use Ki-67 and it's very much a part of our classification system. It's very much a part of our prognostication and our treatment-making, decision-making pathway. But we all recognize the Ki-67 is a proliferation index. And it's not, you know, there's not like there's some magical cutoffs. We've created cutoffs, but they're not magical. And we know that, you know, tumors are heterogeneous. And, you know, biopsying at a certain spot may introduce that you may be in a hot spot or a not so hot spot. So it's a continuum, basically. So the higher grade twos, I would also consider potentially, you know, being a good option for first line radioligand therapy, especially those that have bulky disease or that we're seeing them grow at a fast clinical pace.
Pam, any comments? You said this decision comes up very often in terms of ludotatate versus chemo.
No, this is a very common decision. And I think we are in a sort of fortunate position in 2024 where we have many approved therapies, but we don't have a sort of known perfect sequence of how to use these therapies. And so we're starting to see more and more trials that are comparing active agent to active agent. So an example of one of those is a trial that's through the National Clinical Trial Network, through the Alliance Group, that's comparing ludotatate versus CAPTEM for pancreatic NET. So a perfect example of like really where we need the data. So both of those options are perfectly reasonable for patients, just like Simran described. Well, diff grade 3, bulky disease, where we are in need an objective tumor shrinkage. And both of those trials separately showed about a response rate of 40%. So let's compare them head to head and get that prospective data.
So as is often the case in our webinars, I get tied up asking questions from the chat room. So I've skipped over some of the slides, but go back and check them out, particularly the survey of the investigators. We're bringing up a lot of the questions, but maybe not showing every single slide. I want to make sure we get through the major topics here. And the other one, again, really of, you know, treatment decision-making value here is TKIs, and particularly what we've seen recently with cabozantinib. So first, just starting out, Simran, can you talk a little bit about the history of using TKIs and what do we know about TKIs in general? And also in general, do you view this as sort of a VEGF-related cancer?
Yeah. So we've had a long history, I guess, for neuroendocrine at least, in using TKIs and targeted therapy in neuroendocrine cancers. You know, we've had one of some of the first agents that were improved when it came to targeted therapies, which were sunitinib as well as everolimus, which were both shown to be effective in pancreatic neuroendocrine cancers. And then everolimus subsequently in really lung as well as GI neuroendocrine tumors. And in fact, everolimus remains currently the only one approved agent for lung neuroendocrine tumors, unfortunately. And so the development has really gone on from there. In terms of your question about, you know, do I think of neuroendocrine tumors as VEGF sensitive tumors? Absolutely. We've had a number of studies that have shown that, in fact, that VEGF inhibitors work, radiating right from sunitinib. There's been smaller studies that have shown really good results. Drugs like lenvatinib that have also been useful, but, you know, certainly haven't gone on. And there was a large trial on surufatinib that was done primarily in an Asian population that also showed efficacy. But really, the bell of the ball right now, the player of the day, is cabozantinib. We've had some early results from that study, which is really, I think it's going to make this the TKI of choice. I don't know if you agree, Pam.
Totally agree.
And actually, here are some results from the survey we asked about. So first of all, we asked the investigators, have you already used cabo outside a clinical trial? Everybody has in a number of patients. What's your experience with people say, you know, that it reflected on what's been seen, which we're going to talk about in a second, in the trial in terms of efficacy and tolerability? We asked what kind of tolerability issues are seen. Pam, you mentioned fatigue and diarrhea, that you start out with a 40 milligram dose. Fatigue and diarrhea is something that a number of people, hypertension, mentioned as well. But let's talk about this study, the CABINET study, looking at cabo versus placebo. Pam, can you talk about what they looked at, what was seen, and what your take is and what it means?
Sure. So this was a study led by Dr. Jennifer Chan, again, through the National Clinical Trial Network. And it was a study that was really two studies in one. So two separate cohorts, a pancreatic NET cohort and an extra pancreatic NET cohort. This is done, and I think a really important takeaway, that we really think pancreatic NET and extra pancreatic NET are different diseases, so we really need to be studying them separately. Patients within those cohorts were randomized 2-to-1 to receive either cabozantinib at 60 milligrams or placebo with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. So here we have the primary endpoint slide of median progression-free survival. So on the left is the extra pancreatic NET cohort, and on the right is the pancreatic NET cohort. So cabozantinib prolonged progression-free survival in both cohorts. You can see about an absolute difference of 5 months in the EP NET cohort and about 8 months in the pancreatic NET cohort. So statistically significant in both. I think what's interesting and really an important takeaway from this study is data on the response rate. So response rate is still relatively low in the extra pancreatic NET cohort, but I think what was a pleasant surprise to me, is the response rate of 18% in the pancreatic NET cohort. So that's the highest amongst TKIs that we've seen in prospective studies. I think to Simran's point, this is really going to, I think, become the TKI of choice. I think in part because of the strong data that we're seeing in PFS and the response rate in PNET. We see this as a class effect in terms of side effects. So hypertension, fatigue, diarrhea, slightly different side effects between the EPNET and PNET cohort, but this is really as we've expected to see in this class. This is my slide of the kind of trail of other TKI studies. Simran sort of addressed this, but really just to say that TKIs work in this disease. These agents did not move forward for a whole variety of both strategic reasons and other, but really happy to see that the cabinet study has moved forward.
So Simran, can you talk a little bit more about your experience with Cabo in these patients in terms of tolerability and also what you've observed in terms of efficacy?
Yeah, I mean, I would say what I'm seeing is similar to what we saw in the trial. So that's really encouraging for me when we're starting to see real life data, at least, or real life experience, maybe in this point of view, reflecting the clinical trial. In terms of tolerability, I would say it's fairly well tolerated. Hypertension can be an issue, but those are all, you know, modifiable. We're able to deal with hypertension. There is some fatigue, but certainly I would say manageable. Mostly, I start my patients off at a lower dose and then titrate up. The CABINET trial looked at a dose of 60 milligrams, which I find may be hard for some patients to take from the get-go. So I start my patients at a lower dose, and I find that not everybody makes it up to the full 60 milligram dose.
So, Pam, would you like to take a case from the chat room from Jan? She has a case of a patient with a submandibular nodal mass. Biopsy shows high-grade NET, Q67 more than 90%. PET dotatate shows widespread bone mets, submandibular lesion. No uptake in the lung, liver, or GI tract. No history of Merkel cell. Plans to start carboplatin, wondering about adding an ICI. Any thoughts about this case?
So, good question. My personal practice would be to start with carboplatin alone. I think, again, we just don't have that prospective data. Although I will say we don't know the primary for this particular patient. So, if it were lung, maybe you would add a tiso. Outside the lung, maybe you would not. For my high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas, I do get somatic profiling. I think it's helpful. I think, for example, if this patient were to have really high tumor mutation burden or we got lucky and found a targetable mutation, I don't wait to start first-line therapy, but I get that cooking earlier than I would for neuroendocrine tumors.
So, Simran, speaking of small cell, any action in terms of bispecifics? We got tarlatamab in small cell, CD3 bispecific. Also, any ADCs in development? Seems like that might make sense as well.
Yeah, I think exactly. You know, we've, as Pam said before, we've borrowed from the small cell world a bit, given the similarities of our neuroendocrine carcinomas. So there are some ADCs in development, and we're hoping to be able to launch trials on them later this year or early next year. And I think, a couple targets, like there's at the NCI right now, they already have one, a first in human trial for ADCs in this patient population looking at DLL3. So I do think it's going to be a promising future in terms of, therapies. It's a really unmet need. You know, unfortunately, these patients with neuroendocrine carcinoma, we treat them with first line, chemotherapy, you know, and as Pam mentioned, plus or minus IO. But after that, we really don't have much to offer them. There's really not a standard second line therapy. And so I think we really need to, and these patients have very aggressive disease and need therapies and they need them fast. So I'm really happy to see that we're actually making some progress in that area.
Anything you want to add to that, Pam? And also, I had skipped over another question that we could ask anytime here in terms of biomarkers that are useful in following patients, any MRD or cell-free DNA studies being done, and any thoughts about Simran's comments?
Agree with Simran's comments. I think, Simran and I are a little bit biased, but I think somatostatin receptors are a great target that are worthy of drug development. So I'll leave it at that. I think we need to explore that more. In terms of thinking about cell-free DNA, I think the challenge is that if we think about neuroendocrine tumors, the well-differentiated kind, they truly have low mutation burden to begin with. So they generally don't have a lot of shedding of tumor DNA for us to follow. And then even if we did find some, they generally are not going to have targetable or actionable mutation. So it's tricky. I think that for my well-diff grade threes, I will sometimes check. I will sometimes re-biopsy. A question that often comes up, and I think I saw it on one of your slides, Neil, is this idea, can the grade change over time? And yes, it can. So if I see a patient that has clinical behavior that is out of proportion to what the original biopsy showed me, that it just doesn't make sense, I will re-biopsy. Or if it's a tricky biopsy, I will sometimes get sort of liquid biopsy. But Simran, I don't know what your practice is.
Absolutely. I think we have a low threshold for re-biopsy. Anytime that the clinical behavior just isn't behaving the way we would expect it to based on, you know, the predictive markers that we have and the prognostic markers that we have, we would re-biopsy. And it does happen. It absolutely does happen. It's well described. And it's important that we adjust our therapy accordingly. So I think the key message to listeners would be a low threshold to re-biopsy. Don't be afraid to re-biopsy if the disease is growing faster than you would expect it to.
So I want to get your thoughts on some other new advances or developments in the field and where that might be heading, particularly curious about belzutifan, which is such a fascinating story in renal cell and, of course, is utilized in this situation as well. So we talked a little bit about testing before, but one thing I was curious about in renal now, it looks like belzutifan is being used in sporadic, not just in VHL. Is that something that's being looked into with NETs, Pam? But also in patients who do have a VHL mutation, where do you bring in belzutifan? I mean, kind of you think you want to bring it in first, but you tell me from a practical perspective. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think, I'm not aware of belzutifan being explored yet in sporadic pancreatic NETs. So to be determined. But in terms of using belzutifan in pancreatic NETs, I think that, like Simran said earlier, I generally will recommend germline testing in most of my patients with pancreatic NETs. I think that we know that about 10 to 15% may have germline mutations. So it's actually higher than was previously thought based on a number of studies. And VHL is usually part of that panel that's tested. Now, VHL itself is a very rare germline mutation. And then only about 5 to 15% of patients with VHL even get pancreatic NETs. So this is going to be a very rare population. I've personally not given belzutifan to a patient yet. So I don't know if Simran has personal experience with this. I think that it's certainly an option amongst these patients. I would probably use it earlier rather than later. I'll remind our audience that on that study, there were only about 20 patients with biopsy-proven pancreatic NETs, but they had about a 90% response rate. So like very high. So I think, you know, consider using it, but I think that most of us, even those of us who treat NETs, don't see it very often.
What about the, Simran, the anemia that's seen with belzutifan? How do you manage that? Are ESAs helpful?
You know, again, I don't have experience having managed the day-to-day. I was involved in the care of one patient who received belzutifan, but I wasn't involved in the actual day-to-day administration. So I can't say I could speak from experience, but my understanding has been is that for those rare patients who have VHL, they certainly do quite well. And I would imagine that, like other malignancies, we can manage the anemia, whether it be with proactive ESA or close monitoring and support as needed. But to me, that risk-benefit ratio seems to make a lot of sense.
So, Pam, in your talk, you reviewed the data on belzutifan. You were kind of alluding to it, but can you talk a little bit about what they saw there when they looked at these pancreatic NET patients?
Sure. So this was a recent, relatively small study, I should say. So they looked at both pancreatic lesions that were not necessarily biopsy proven as neuroendocrine tumor. And they also looked at about 20 patients with pancreatic NETs. And maybe you can go to the next slide. We'll highlight just really the key takeaways. So as you can see in this waterfall plot, which I'll just remind the audience that the way to look at this is that each bar represents an individual patient. 30% or more shrinkage, which is below the line, represents a partial response. So really the large majority of these patients, 20 of them fell into that category of having a partial response. So in about a 91% official response rate, 32% with a CR and 59% with a PR in that red box there with the pancreatic NETs. So this is just an image showing screening to week 43 to week 202 of having a confirmed complete response, which is, I think, very exciting. So, I mean, I think this just really speaks to the idea of like very targeted therapy. This targets a specific germline mutation and is right for the right patient.
So, Simran, you may not have used belzutifan, but Hassan in the chat room has a 35-year-old patient with a cerebellar hemangioblastoma, spinal cord, bilateral renal RCC, pancreatic NET, on belzutifan for 6 months in remission. So I guess that lines up that waterfall plot we just saw there. Anything
that
else?
That seems to be the case that we're hearing when it's appropriate, and when the, you know, although not as common, but when it is appropriate, the response rates are quite good, and the patients seem to be benefiting quite a bit from the drug.
So last thing I want to bring up to the two of you is where you think things are heading. You know, we've already talked about how much has happened over the last few years, Pam. What are some of the things you're looking forward to over the next 3 to 5 years? Clinical trial concepts, management concepts, where do you think we're going to be in the next 5 years?
Well, I think if the last 10 is any indication, I think that there will be a lot of movement. I think, again, it's an exciting time. I try to impart that hope to the patients. I think, really excited to see the direction of radioligand therapy, how we can make it better, safer, novel radioisotopes, different ways to target the somatostatin receptor itself. So those are areas I'm excited about.
Simran, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of areas I think are really exciting. I mean, what we've been doing, I think, over the last 10, 15, 20 years has been really understanding these tumors a bit better, rather than clumping them all together, is trying to understand the different subpopulations that exist within this big umbrella of neuroendocrine cancer, and trying to find the right treatments for them. And, you know, trials like we look at like the NETTER-2 trial, which looked at a higher grade population, and we look at, you know, other trials that have come through. We are seeing that we're able to sort of use the factors that we have, disease site differentiation, proliferation index, tumor growth rate, increasingly SSTR expression, as indicators for the right treatment. So I think a lot of work is going to be done further at trying to tailor the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. Sequencing is going to be important. As Pam mentioned, in terms of radioligand therapy, you know, we're sort of leading the cancer world in this. You know, the first disease site to be using this this new way of treating cancer that breaks out of the buckets of surgical oncology, medical oncology, radiation oncology, this new area. And so I can think we'll continue sort of leading the cancer world in this area in terms of, as Pam said, making it better, making it safer, and understanding, you know, one of the areas I'm really interested in is retreatment. You know, once we treat once, is it safe to do it again? Is it effective to do it again? You know, where does that fit in the treatment algorithm? Then, as you mentioned, Neil, like the ADCs, the BiTE therapy, you know, for the poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, an area of unmet need. Absolutely, we dire need more treatments. And so I think that will also be a very exciting area, as well as we develop these trials in lung cancer, lung neuroendocrine cancer. We don't have enough treatments for that. So we're starting to develop some new treatments for those areas. So filling in the gaps is going to be really important. Yeah.
So I'll add my own little CME or treatment of fantasy that maybe in 5 years we'll have you all and experts in diseases that are not that common, a lot better tied in to people in practice and to patients. I mean, we have telemedicine. I'm very disappointed that we're not using it more. I'm expecting that we're going to figure out ways to be able to. There's just no reason we can't run cases by you all electronically, and I hope that's going to be coming in the near future. Anyhow, Pam and Simran, so thank you so much for chatting with us today. Audience, thank you for tuning in. coming back next Wednesday. We're going to be talking about CAR T and then diffuse large B cell at the SoHo meeting. Be safe, stay well, and have a great Labor Day weekend. Thanks so much, Pam. Thanks, Imran.
Thank you.
Thank
have
you.
Have a good one.